This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, Wayfair workers protest furniture sale to detention centers caging immigrant children.
But first,
labor is raising the roof in Nashville.
As construction booms in Nashville, workers are finding the power to unionize in the otherwise non-union South. The city is growing and developers are putting up new corporate headquarters, entertainment venues, and luxury hotels fast as they possibly can. There is power shifting in the city, and we'll find out more about how that's happening and how Nashville's construction trades workers are raising the roof against corporate greed.
With Chris Brooks, staff writer, organizer for Labor Notes magazine, Odessa Kelly with Nashville Organize for Action and Hope and co-chair of Stand Up Nashville, and Anne Barnett, the Central Labor Council of Nashville, and co-chair of Stand Up Nashville.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Conditions. Let's start with Chris, who actually wrote the article which inspired us to do this show. Chris, why don't we begin by talking about the conditions of the construction workers, despite the fact that there's this housing boom and labor shortage. How are the workers doing in Nashville?
Well, thank you for having me on. So me and my co-author, Rebecca Gibbon, who's a professor at Rutgers University, recently published a piece called Labor Raises the Floor in Nashville at the American Prospect. We really identified how Nashville, like many cities across the country, is undergoing an economic boom right now. And in the midst of that, we're seeing deep inequality. Lots of capital investment is coming into the city. Corporate headquarters are popping up there. You've got HCA Healthcare, Mitsubishi, Skanska, Gibson Guitars, the Corrections Corporations of America, Nissan, it could go on and on. They're all moving to the South where they can pay fewer taxes and where they can public make an investment and subsidize the development of these new headquarters. And in the midst of that, the construction industry is really reaching all-time high profits. They set a record last year of $2 trillion in the industry. But very, very little of that revenue is trickling down to the workers. Like most of the economy, we're seeing wages have remained stagnant. And in the South, they're facing incredibly harsh conditions on these work sites. Like many people may know that when you build a building, you hire a general contractor. That contractor then hires subcontractors who are in competition with one another, and they may hire crews of workers from staffing agencies that are temp employees. There is steep competition between these subcontractors. They often misclassify employees as independent contractors to get out of paying taxes and providing them with the benefits they deserve. They often steal their wages. They deny them health care. They cut corners on safety. The injury rate on many of these work sites is astronomical. And the workers in these conditions are often suffering. And not only are they making very little for the industry in the South, but oftentimes the employers just not paying them their overtime or not paying them the set amount that they agreed to. Wage theft is very, very common. And of course, many of these workers are disproportionately Latino. Some of them are undocumented, and that creates a lot of fear in organizing and fighting back. But despite all of that, what we're seeing that's really phenomenal is that many of the construction trades there are beginning to take innovative approaches to actually meet these workers where they are, to organize them on the job site, and to start fighting back to change these really grotesque conditions. It's been really incredible to see.
Part of what you're saying is the construction boom and the oppressive conditions that are there actually carry with them perhaps the seeds of their own destruction. And that means that capital is opposed to and labor is on the move, can take advantage of the shortage of labor, etc., and is on the move. So, Odessa and Anne, why don't you tell us about the kind of organizations that you formed and indeed how labor is on the move to advance its interests in this corporate boomtown?
Great. Well, thanks for having us on. I'd like to start off by saying,
is that Odessa?
One of the lessons, this is Anne.
Okay, Anne, take us.
From the Central Labor Council of Nashville and also one of the co-chairs of Stand Up Nashville. So one of the lessons that we learned pretty early on in this boom is that we are much stronger together than we are apart. And that might seem pretty obvious to many people, but we've got each individual building trades union trying to organize their sector of the work, or maybe not trying to organize, quite frankly. We've got community groups who are fighting against displacement and fighting against gentrification, or fighting to fight for 15 type campaigns. We really realize that up against this tremendous flood of capital that's coming into our city, we can't all have our own individual strategies. We need to band together, form a coalition like Stand Up Nashville that brings the unions to the table, that brings the housing justice folks to the table, that brings immigrant justice folks to the table, to really have a holistic strategy to combat what we're seeing happen to our city on many different fronts.
Odessa, clearly what Ann's talking about is building bridges, not walls, a community labor strategy. Talk further about that and how you and Anne have come together. We're getting a little bit of an echo here, but we'll do our best.
This is Odessa Kelly, also the co-chair of Stand Up Nashville. Like Anne said, thank you for having us on. It's been a long journey. We started 3 years ago. To give you some of the background of what was going on in Nashville, I was a member of NOAA, Organizer Action and Hope. Through NOAA, we had a local hire initiative here that went on the ballot, and basically we were asking that 40% of all new development that came to Nashville would have Davidson County residents on it. So we got it on the ballot. It passed. We had an inclusionary zoning ballot. We got on the ballot. It passed as well. We had banned the box here in Nashville. All these things that it passed. So we're walking around feeling really proud. Then that's when I found out about this thing called preemption. State walked in January and took everything away that the residents of Nashville had voted for. So preemption is when the state steps in and takes away something that you've done on the local level. So we passed through our Nashville, through our local municipalities, all these initiatives. Then the state legislature stepped in and says that we could not do those things. So therefore, even though we passed in Nashville, the state said we cannot do it. So we've been restricted on a lot of progressive things that we wanted to pass in Nashville, strictly because of the state having the right to preempt us on things.
When you say the state says you can't do this, how do ballot initiatives that pass wind up being that the state says you can't do them after this incredible organizing and mobilizing drive? Could you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. This is Anne.
Go ahead, Anne.
I'll just jump in and say basically what the state does, they either interpret existing law or literally just pass a new law to say the jurisdiction for whatever this is belongs to the state and not the city or the county. Therefore, y'all can't do anything unless it comes through the state. So they've done that on wages. They've done that on hiring. They've done that on inclusionary housing initiatives that cities have tried to pass. They basically pass a law saying cities don't have the ability to decide this. Only the state does.
Now, you've gotten around that by getting around the government.
That's right.
By negotiating this community benefits agreement, especially with regard to a new soccer team that's coming into Nashville. So what is that all about?
I appreciate that you recognize that that's a strategy to get around state preemption, because I'll tell you, people like to think about the South as being anti-union, but the most brilliant union organizers I've ever met are in the South, and that's why we face so many more challenges, but we're still smart enough to come up with new strategies and new tactics to get around them and still win. So that was the idea behind the Community Benefits Agreement. It's an agreement between a community organization, in this case Stand Up Nashville, our organization, and the developer of a new project. Basically, the developer kind of quote-unquote voluntarily agrees to uphold certain labor standards, to use registered apprentices on the job, to include affordable housing, or whatever else the community might demand that it go into this agreement. And keeping that out of the realm of the government, keeping that out of the city or the state, and maintaining it as a private agreement, the state can't come in and intervene in a private contract between two parties. So in this case, the community benefits agreement that we won was on the soccer stadium. We did intervene. Our choke point was with city council, with Metro Council, because they had to approve a number of rezoning, demolition, bonds, all sorts of things that the city council had to approve. And individually, we won over the Metro Council members to tell the developers, in order to win my vote on this, you're going to have to go meet with them, and I want to see a community benefits agreement. So we really used the chokehold of these different zoning bills and things like that that the developers had to get pushed through to intervene to have leverage in negotiating the CBA.
And Odessa, I want to understand, how do you organize? Like, I know you've been involved with the iron workers, the painters, et cetera, the construction trades. How do you begin to create a sense and a sensitivity of the benefit of labor organizing to enhance wages and benefits and community life?
To simply say is just keeping like the bigger goal that all of us have in common as what is most important. Once we lost all those initiatives, one thing is I realized is that we can't just do this by ourselves, that we have to come together with labor unions up to that point who were really strong in just pushing like some of the most progressive and social agendas that were going on in the South, so that we can have, how does it say, there's power in people and power in money. So I wanted to organize both of them, and that's exactly what we did. Partnership with working families who was come down and been a godsend, working with Stand Up Nashville, they did this report called the Build the Better South Report. And in that Build the Better South Report, there were a lot of egregious things that were happening to the everyday working people, people who are my neighbors, who I, you know, did construction work out here in the field every day. So we took these people along with a lot of the atrocities that were going on in Nashville, and this all comes from the same place. Development has had the largest and biggest negative impact on Nashville, hands down. It's cyclical across the board, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's stagnation in wages, whether it is to pumping up a city where it's pushing all the working and normal class people out to the edges of the city. So those are some of the things that we talked about when we brought everyone together to sit at a table. It was hard, you know, but one thing we want to do is make sure that we did it right. So we spent a good 18 months strategizing with what is the best way to go about this, of doing this, because other people have attempted it in the past and it failed. And that's one thing we weren't going to do. You know, we wanted to make sure that we got real results for the people in Nashville. So we sat back and we looked at, like, how do we govern ourselves? What are the processes that we go through? And I can't thank Partnerships for Working Families enough for coming down and helping being a guide on, because they're the ones that introduced us to the community benefits agreement, and that being a good tool or resource that we could use to get around the preemption that was happening in the state.
And Chris Brooks from Labor Notes, you've been following the teacher struggles around the country, and there seems to be a teacher struggle in Memphis right now, both in terms of improving the classroom experience of the children and also raising the wages of workers. So why don't you talk about that?
So in Nashville, the teachers have been organized to raise their wages. The Metro City government and the school board have effectively frozen them for many years. So teachers that were promised raises never received them. And they were, you know, packing out school board meetings. They were doing what are called walk-ins, which is kind of like the opposite of a walk-out, where the teachers would all line the sidewalks out front of the school to greet parents and students on their way in with signs telling and flyers telling them about what their struggles about and trying to encourage them to turn out to their events. And then they actually had a citywide rally and a sick-out, which had about 20% of the teachers participate in it, where they were putting pressure on all of the local bodies there to try to increase funding for public education. And while it hasn't been immediately successful in Nashville, I think it's such an incredible start to see that level of energy being brought to the city and how people are connecting these fights, especially around how we're using taxpayer money to, you know, subsidize all these private companies when, in fact, we should be using them to fund things like public education and to ensure that living wages are, you know, provided to all workers in the city. And just very briefly, you know, I think what's so incredible about what Ann and Odessa is saying is that there's really a twofold kind of strategy that's taking place here. And the tight labor market that we see in Nashville, these construction workers are capable of threatening walkouts and strikes on the job because they can literally just go across the street and get a job. And they're able to raise wages and standards by doing that. And then on the other side is they have these really powerful community labor coalitions like Stand Up Nashville and NOAA that are capable of coming in, then before a development even starts, even breaks ground, they're capable of having a deal in place to ensure that there'll be safe working conditions and higher wages. So the innovative strategies that they're using there are really worth noting all around the country, and I think are going to be inspiring to other cities across the South.
Time races ahead. But Ann and Odessa and Chris, if you could each take a minute to tell us what you think we up south, if you will, need to learn about the kind of organizing on behalf of the working class that's going on now in Nashville. And why don't we start with you, go to Odessa, and take it out with Chris.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the biggest lessons to be learned is that we are scrappy down here. We oftentimes don't have resources. We're oftentimes doing this work after we work our full-time paid job, and we're doing it for free, right? And so I think one of the things to learn, if you have something to believe in, then you just go for it, and you get real creative about how to figure out how to make it work.
Is that true, Odessa?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think one of the things that we've been good at doing is that know that things are bigger than just yourself, right? So what we've been really good at doing is just building our community. You know, when we were doing these things, the power that we have is the power of the people. Honestly, what separates us from a lot of other groups is that we actually took the time to go out and survey the whole community. I've been in every community in Nashville. We took the time to really sit down and talk to people and really listen about what their concerns are, right? We then now bring those concerns back to the powers to be, and we advocate that way.
Chris, what do you think this all means? What are the lessons that we learn in terms of pushing ahead and organizing and revitalizing our labor movement?
Well, you know, the South is the most populous and diverse region in the country, and yet it has the lowest union density. So it's abundantly clear that there's immense power there if unions know how to tap it, if they know how to bring people in and organize them together successfully to fight employers and the inequality that we're facing, not just in the South, but all across the country. And I think Ann and Odessa have done such a great job of showing how that can be done. So all eyes should be on Nashville.
Well, they are going to be now. Labor is raising the roof in Nashville with Chris Brooks, who's tuning us into this. And do check out Labor Notes magazine. Odessa Kelly, thank you for the work that you're doing. We'll stay in touch. Co-chair of Stand Up Nashville, and Ann Barnett, co-chair of Stand Up Nashville as well. And y'all are showing the way. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on.
And now we move swiftly to an enormously exciting development. Wayfair workers protesting the furniture sale to detention centers caging immigrant children. And we're about to speak with April Glasser, reporter for Slate and co-host of the podcast, If Then.
But first, a brief news clip on the demonstration in Boston.
A line of Wayfair workers left their offices, carried signs a couple of blocks, and gathered on Copley Square.
I'm proud of the people who joined us today, whether you're a Wayfarian or not.
The crowd numbered several hundred people.
I don't want my company to be profiting off of human rights violations.
Workers say they found out last week Wayfair plans to sell $200,000 worth of beds to a border detention camp in Texas that's being built for migrant children from Central America.
If a code of ethics does not prevent a sale like this, I have no idea why we'd even bother having one.
We saw a report of them taking away beds from kids when they got angry at them, I believe, over combs and the lice outbreak that happened at this institution. So, you know, in my eyes, like, that means they're using beds for leverage.
In a letter to employees, Wayfair's co-founder said the company would donate $100,000 to the Red Cross. Workers said fine, but not enough.
It's not like they're doing nothing. It's just we want more.
Workers say their managers have promised they will not be punished, at least not for taking part in this protest.
Are you not worried you could lose your job?
I'm worried that I could, well, I'm not worried, but I could lose my job.
April Glasser, thank you for your reporting. This is a wonderful, magnificent development of the working class. Workers went out over a humanitarian principle. So set the stage for us about these employees on this online home furnishing retailer Wayfair that we see commercials about constantly, who walked off the job to protest the company's decision to sell $200,000 worth of furniture to a government contractor that runs a detention center for migrant children in Texas. And thanks for joining us.
Yes, no, thanks for having me. It's a fascinating topic and an event that happened, and it's still likely unfolding in some ways. So the Friday before last,
Friday, over 500 employees did send a letter to executives at Wayfair, so employees of Wayfair, about the order of furniture that somebody had flagged that was slated to be shipped to the Carrizo Springs, Texas detention center. And quickly those employees, they found out about the furniture order in the middle of the week. They quickly started drafting a letter, got more people, got, you know, hundreds of employees to sign on, over 500, sent it on Friday. That Monday they heard back from Wayfair, and the company basically said, no way. They said, quote, in a response to the employees saying, and the employees, by the way, were demanding that Wayfair create a policy so that the way this doesn't happen again, and to donate the profits from this sale, since it was too late to undo the sale, to donate those profits to RACES, a nonprofit in Texas that's been doing a lot of legal support for immigrants at the border. And what happened was Wayfair said they're not going to meet their demands. They said, quote, as a retailer, it's standard practice to fulfill orders for all customers. We believe it's our business to sell to any customer who's acting within the laws of the country we operate in. So Wayfair basically said, you know, this what's happening isn't illegal. It's happening by the government, and so it's not our place to step in and say anything. The employees were not happy with that on Monday. So on Tuesday, they announced plans that they were going to walk out of the Boston headquarters, where Wayfair is based, on Wednesday, and holding their demands up, saying that, you know, we still demand that you donate the profits of this, that we are not working for a company that's profiting off of these detention centers, and you donate the profits to a nonprofit that's working to help these families, and then you make some sort of policy saying that this, so that way we know that something like this isn't going to happen again, some sort of ethics policy. When they announced they were going to walk out, that got leaked to the press, and they created a Twitter account. It amassed, you know, thousands of followers in a few hours. It saturated the news. And everybody was watching, and when they walked out on Wednesday, it turned into a very, very, very large event. And, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about this is that if this was some small company that no one had heard of, or some company that has less of a frontward-facing image and less of a brand that's recognizable, then this protest probably would not have been successful. And so what we see here are employees organizing, not for the betterment of their conditions. They have rather less jobs. They're working for a tech company. But rather for political organizing, to change the ethical practices of the company that they're in, not to better their own condition. So it's a really a fascinating action.
Well, the Times article on it was interesting because it emphasized that this might lead to a consumer boycott of the company. Have you heard that also?
Well, immediately once it became public that Wayfair was had accepted an order and was, you know, ostensibly then profiting off of this order of beds, that immediately customers took to Twitter, to Facebook, and announced that they were no longer going to be working with Wayfair. And these were people who said they run large corporate accounts, people who went on to say they spend thousands a month, you know, staging events and homes and what have you with this furniture. They said they're dropping it. So, you know, the spark of a boycott did happen. People did say they were going to stop working with Wayfair and stop purchasing from them. And so it was really interesting because we saw employees organizing and we saw customers organizing in support of those employees. And just to follow up with what happened here, Wayfair did say on Wednesday, the day of the walkout, that they were going to donate $100,000 to the Red Cross. The Wayfair employees praised this, but noted that this is not the nonprofit that's helping families that they asked for. And I'm not sure of whether or not an ethics statement has been formed yet, but I don't believe so. So they did end up donating the profits to a nonprofit that helps people, but the Red Cross isn't the primary organization that's helping on the border.
And April, are you aware of any repercussions for the workers? I mean, this is such a courageous act. When I think of somebody says, well, what do you mean by socialism? What I think about is not so much state planning and things. I think it's about when workers make decision over that which they work, where they work, the things that they manufacture and so on, and that the hell with the bosses. They become the ones who are making the decisions. And invariably, the decisions are much more righteous and thoughtful. They're not going to pay the Jeff Bezos of the world or Bezos, you know, millions of dollars or billions. So what's happened with these workers, and how do you analyze this, the enormity of this decision of the workers to say, be damned what happens to us. We cannot countenance this company contributing to the abuses of children, symbolically or otherwise, on the border.
Well, I don't know if they said we'll be damned what happened to us, but they did say that they're going to organize to come together and try to change the practices of their company, of the enterprise that they work in, and to make those practices more ethical, and to somehow have a better reassurance that their paycheck is coming from a line of business that they are ethically aligned with. And they organized to push their employer to do that and to be better.
And April, just to end this off, but briefly, if you could mention, there's been a lot of other employee protests around, especially tech companies, from Google to Microsoft to Amazon. We're not going to give you too much time on this, but if you could just do that in a minute or two.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to mention. So I haven't heard of any repercussions to employees to answer the rest of that question, but this is actually happening as there's been a string of worker actions across the tech industry. A couple years ago, last year, Google employees organized to protest and circulated a petition that received thousands of signatures against an AI project that Google was building with the Department of Defense that would have provided software for drones. And that employee organizing first forced Google Google then announced that they were not going to renew their contract with the Department of Defense after that employee organizing. We've also seen Microsoft workers organize and petition their boss, saying we would like Microsoft to stop providing software for immigration, for ICE. We saw Salesforce employees do this with Salesforce, because Salesforce does list Border Patrol as a customer. So we have in the past year seen tech workers in particular who have rather comfortable jobs organizing for their companies that they work for to not engage with government agencies and government programs that they are opposed to and that they consider to be kind of following through with inhumane policies. And so this is interesting because this is actually them not just signing.
And we have about 30 seconds more.
Well, yeah, stepping out and organizing a walkout.
April Glasser, we're going to have to stay close friends and bring you back. April is a reporter for Slate and co-host, our sister entity, really, the podcast, If Then. So we have to have a closer relationship. Thank you for the reporting. Yes, Wayfair workers protest furniture sale to detention centers, caging immigrant children. And thank you for those other examples of tech companies where the workers have taken a principled and humane stance. Oh, yes, workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains.
You have a world to win. We have a world to win.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.